The general topic for today is stability. And that can be an umbrella term for a variety of different modes of being. We can be stable. We can be steady, steadied. We can be grounded, balanced, maybe calm, all kind of ways of being that are conducive for other purposes besides themselves. Some of you, some of us, might be quite happy with those by themselves, just like, oh, this feels good. One analogy that I like for stability, the value of it, is a tripod. You know, if you're riding on a flatbed train, you know, like a cargo train, just and you're out in the open, holding a big, long telescope, trying to look at the moon, you're not going to have much luck. The train is wobbling back and forth, shaking. It's so heavy for your arms to hold this telescope. You can't even, you know, just, it's kind of crazy how much it swings back and forth. But you get down the solid ground, and you put the telescope on a tripod, and then it's steadied, it's stable, and you can focus in on the moon and see all the carnage of spaceships have crashed into it. We're making a mess of that now too. Now, and. Another simile for that comes a little more closer to home for me, that when I was growing up, there was plenty of times that I went out rowing in a wooden rowboat, usually with other people, maybe always with other people, into the North Sea and off the coast of Norway. And it was kind of, there were waves. It was kind of choppy. And so occasionally there was a reason to stand in the rowboat. And it could be really fun, provided you were standing at middle of the boat in a stable way, kind of spanning the middle section, kind of in the middle of the boat, not too far forward, not too far back, not too far on one side or the other. And then you could stand with your legs wide, and as the boat would move in different ways, you would just shift your weight from one side to the other, bend your knees or stretch your knees out, and you can kind of stay pretty steady doing what you had to do. But if you moved over, and let's say you try to stand both legs on one side, right up against the side of the rowboat, you'd probably get fall in the water. You know, you go up and down, you wouldn't have the stability to keep yourself, you know, stable, to keep yourself kind of flowing and moving with the changes. So our lives change all the time. And how do we move, flow with the changes? How do we shift and change? Where do we stand in the middle of it all, so that we can adjust in a nice way? There's one of the terms for equanimity in the ancient world, in Pali Buddhist world, is standing in the middle of it all. So how do you take a stand here? How are you rooted here in such a way that you're fluid, you can move and flow with things and adjust as you need to, but the stability and steadiness here. The telescope analogy works well for really looking deep inside of ourselves. It's hard to see ourselves if we're agitated. It's hard to know the depth of ourselves if we're spinning out in thoughts and fragmented thoughts jumping around from this to that. But if our thinking mind can be settled, maybe the rest of the whole body is a tripod upon which the thinking mind can rest and be still, then we can see deep into the operating systems of our lives and see what's happening in a deeper way that is probably impossible if the mind is agitated, spinning. We would just swing, like just like we swing by the moon with a big telescope. As we try so hard to understand ourselves, see ourselves, the more we try to understand, the more we're agitated and more we just swing and don't have the stillness to really take a good look. Am I loud enough with the volume? Yeah, for everyone? Okay. So to steady ourselves, to find place of stability, balance, is a very important thing. Part of the reason for this theme this week is that I noticed when I practiced in Asia, Buddhist monasteries in Japan and Burma, that the rhetoric, what the teachers would actually teach, which was great, but it wasn't the same thing of what we did. And so I thought that was kind of interesting. There's two different things going on here. They say one thing, but there's a whole other thing happening that's implicit. So one of them was, especially in Thailand and Burma, there were endless talks on the three characteristics. I mean, it was like every other talk. You know, things are impermanent, things are unsatisfactory, and things are not self. Over and over and over again. So it was kind of challenging. Sometimes very repetitive. Sometimes, but it gave me a lot of pause and a lot of reflection. What these might mean and how to understand them. But then, at the same time, we were cultivating the opposite of those, and they didn't tell us, you know, there's impermanence, and now cultivate the opposite. But we were. We were being trained to cultivate steadiness, stability, a continuity of helpful states of mind, so they wouldn't be mind wouldn't be shifting and changing and jumping around. The mind would be settled in states of well-being, and actually this experience of well-being, happiness, was encouraged to flow. And they never told us, oh, the happiness is impermanent. They said that everything's impermanent, they would say, but they kind of like wouldn't apply it to happiness, in meditative happiness and joy. They'd keep it going. and there was this kind of expectation, or this pointing to, or this encouragement to practice long enough and deep enough that you started having confidence in the practice, in the Dharma, and in yourself, your ability to practice. And these this is interesting. These are the opposite of what they're teaching all the time. So it turns out that what they were teaching were that what we were supposed to be seeing, the insights of practice that were liberating. What we were cultivating, paradoxically, was the opposite of the insights. We're not cultivating impermanence, we're cultivating stability. We're not cultivating a lot of unsatisfactoriness. Go for it, get it, you know. You know, the word that's here is unsatisfactory is dukkha, which more literally means pain or suffering. So, you know, we're not cultivating suffering. You know, just come to Buddhism and suffer better. Really, we'll show you how. Full lotus all the time. And then we're not, this idea of not self, it's not so that you become kind of like a self-effacing blob who sits on the couch and has nothing going. The Buddha sitting up here, he's been sitting there for good. That statue for me represents a lot of confidence. This is a person who kind of knows who they are and inhabits their being, their life, in a confident, full way without asserting, without pushing, without demanding, just fully here. So this week we're going to go through these first 3 days to do what we cultivate, and that prepares the ground for talking about these insights we have. We create the context for understanding them. Because if we just started off with the insights and what he taught the way sometimes was taught to me in Thailand and Burma, you got to realize everything's impermanent, everything's changing, that's the deal. Well, maybe, but there are people who grew up that way, people who grew up in war zones and horrific change all the time. And I mean, I changed schools 12 times in 12 years growing up, moving a lot. And so for someone who has in change and impermanence has been horrific for them, for them to be told, everything's always changing and permanent, I don't know, they just give up. Like, these Buddhists are just telling me what I already know. And now there's no hope. Or if we say that everything is suffering, everything's unsatisfactory, well, some people are living with such poverty and such horrific situations, such trauma, that to say that everything's unsatisfactory, for them that's been the truth of their life. And if now the Buddha say it too, again, what hope is there? And this not self thing. I mean, there are people for whom society, family, cultures have, ground them down, told them that they don't count, directly or indirectly, denied them their human dignity and value. And some people growing up with that internalize it. And then they come to Buddhism and they hear there's no self. I mean, Jesus. I guess I really don't count at all. There's nothing here to count. So it can be heard and misunderstood in these teachings. But if the context is prepared for it, and a person we are feeling really here, stable, strong, balanced, then the waves come and we stand on the rowboat and we just kind of go with it. It's not a problem. If we have not something, not really unsatisfactoriness, we've realized something really satisfactory. This is good. This well-being, this peace, this joy, this is unparalleled to anything I've had before. This is a joy or happiness is not dependent on the conditions of the world. This is something that arises flowing from within. It's completely, maybe it's temporary, but while it's here, this is good. And so when I was in Burma, the practice brought me a lot of well-being, a lot of joy, and it prepared me for when in the practice I ran into a lot of suffering. And there were periods that was hard, but with periods, the joy just held the suffering. I could see it and be with it in a way I could never have imagined, because the atmosphere, the context of me, who I was able to hold it, the suffering in the joy. And then not self is a very profound and penetrating teaching and idea and insight to have. But it's not supposed to make us not count. the Buddha went around, they say, roaring like a lion. Lions count. I don't think I told you, but I told some recently that when I went to the San Francisco Zoo with my son, he was young enough, I was still holding him in my arms, and I walked up to this cage where the lion was, and the bars were huge. They were strong. But there was no glass. It was just I can get him in 4 feet. I don't think he could have reached us with his claws. But so we were standing there looking at the lion, and he roared, a roar that was primordial. And I didn't have to think what to do. It was, there must be some deep African instinct that's still in me. I turned around and left without, you know, you put your hand on the stove and you pull it off right away. I just left. When a lion speaks like that, you know who's the king. You know who's in charge. So, but the Buddha had a lion's roar when he taught. He had no self, but he had a roar. So that's confidence. No self, but boy, that was a confident no self there. So this teaching of not self is understood, built on this whole foundation of strong confidence. It's a whole different context for understanding it. If you don't have confidence, if you feel like you're unworthy already, and then the Buddha say there's no self, and you know, you don't count, kind of. But if you're confident, sure, I'm happy, no problem. Not self, no self, self, who cares? There's this kind of like this freedom and wonderfulness here. So we're cultivating something really important. We generally, in the insight movement, don't try to cultivate these things directly, because then we're engineering and trying and forcing it, and we get disappointed. But rather, we're creating the conditions that support the growth of these qualities within us. And coming on retreat, a lot of the conditions here are supporting us to quiet down, to settle down, to get settled, to become steady. The silence, the lack of social conversations we have here, allows a certain kind of agitation of many people's minds to quiet. You don't have to figure anything out, and you don't have to be worried they misunderstand me when I said something about their shoes. And I had to go apologize. And, there's people are complicated. And so we're less complicated when we don't talk. And so things get quieter and more peaceful. And then we don't do much here. And so something inside, the muscles can relax slowly. The bellies can relax, the face can relax, all kinds of things just because we're not doing and busy and running around and having to do. And not a few people who go on retreat discover that they actually become more relaxed and peaceful in retreat than they do on a vacation. Not necessarily the first day, but after a week or something, something deep has a chance to settle. And that's maybe, happening on its own, just being here and being in the simplicity of this environment and walking in the trees and the ground outside. And one of the ways this is described is that one of the first steps on a retreat is arriving here. So you're really here. You're here in this place. You're no longer thinking about the Super Bowl, maybe that you missed. That's elsewhere. You're no longer thinking about work. You know, it takes a while to kind of let the ordinary life that we've been carrying with us to kind of begin to shed and settle down and fall away. And because we're often not here and now, the mind is often there and then. And so to be able to shift from there and then mind to here and now mind is the task when we first arrive. And it sometimes takes a few days to really settle down and allow that process to happen. And if we try to force it to happen, it takes longer. So you want to be very careful you're not forcing it, not trying too hard to make it happen. A lot of it is creating the conditions that lets things settle down and relax. So arriving here and in this place, this time, but also arriving not just to the center in this location, but arriving here in this body. Many people live lives where they're ahead of themselves. They're kind of like into the future and planning or going. I remember one of my first Vipassana retreats in Thailand. The teacher kept talking about mindfulness of the body. He said, don't do anything that takes you away from your body. And I didn't quite understand what he was talking about. But I was curious about this statement. And I noticed that we only had two meals a day. And the breakfast was kind of mediocre, small amount. So one meal a day, really. And we had to walk through the forest to get to lunch, down a hill and through the forest. And I started noticing, because I was so hungry, my center of gravity, my sense of who I was or something like that, was actually like a foot ahead of me. I was leaning into it, and like I was already, you know, part of me was ahead of me. And I'd notice it, and I'd say, oh, don't leave your body. And I'd come back, try to walk with me, in me. But I was so hungry. It didn't, you know, and me was ahead of me. And, or we're up in our head, which is, you know, one place to be, but the head is usually not a stable place, a settled place to be. And so we arrive, settle into our body. Our bellies maybe begin to relax. Arms begin to relax. Maybe the thighs soften. Maybe the back. Maybe the chest. Maybe the heart has a chance to relax. And the thinking mind softens, relaxes. And so the things settle down, we're arriving, we're like, oh, we're here, now we're really here. And there's a wonderful slogan in our tradition. It says, if you want the fastest way from A to B is to be fully at A. So whatever you think the goal is in this practice, where you're trying to attain, and to, you know, attain liberation, attain jhana, attain insight, attain, I don't know, joy, happiness, peace, anything you want to get to, that's B. How do you get to B? Really be at A, which means here. This is the place to stabilize ourselves here, to settle ourselves here, to feel ourselves here. This is the place. This is the place. And sometimes in therapeutic circles, they even have people tap their body just to remind them they're here and to get connected and to be here. And we're so ritual poor here at IRC, which I'm probably 100% to blame for. And but you know, there's a lot of like bowing and prostrations and traditional places when you practice. And that's, you know, regardless what you think about the devotional aspects of it, it's very physical and it really puts you in your body. You're engaged in your body. And so we don't have that so much here, but there's things you can do, like really be here. Sometimes on retreat, there's been people who have a really hard time being present at all. They're so challenged by their spinning mind, their reactive mind, their fear mind. And I'll have them go and do walking meditation somewhere far from everyone else, and to walk fast and to stomp. Just really, and really hit the ground and really feel the ground, and just so that you can't not be, you can't not pay attention to what you're doing. You can't be pulled in. You can't. It's difficult not to be pulled into the body because you're really doing it, stomping and fast. And then, you know, it's kind of like a, I don't know, it's a good place to have for anger to go to, that stomping and you can just give it to the earth. It'll take it. It'll love you even more because you're just doing your thing. So all these things is arriving, coming, understanding what your conditions are, how you are when you arrive, and how best to be with it, and how to find a way. How can I be here with myself? How can I be here with myself? And really here with myself. And what I want to do is emphasize the word with. In contrast to, how can I be here as myself? We want you to come as you are. This is as you are party. So please do. But the point here is not to be as you are. That's not the goal. The point is, yes, be as you are, but be with yourself, meaning stand by yourself, stand next to yourself. Satipatthana, the word that for this practice we do, has been by philologists who really dug deeply into the word, have said that it can mean to stand next to. Stand next to yourself, be with yourself. There's a part of you that can be stable and strong. There's a part of you that can be observant and notice and be present. That's like a good friend who goes for a walk with you to hear you when you're troubled, challenged. And they're just there to listen, to be with you, to accompany you, not to judge you, not to fix you. They're just there to be with you, to accompany you and see you and allow you to be as you are. But they're also not becoming you. They're offering something very profound that's different than becoming you. And something really to be accepted and seen like that is very profound. And so we do that for ourselves in this practice. We're here to be with ourselves, to stand next to ourselves, to allow ourselves to be as we are. But don't be sucked into how we are. Don't feel like you have to indulge in it or have to prove it or have to defend it. Just listen. Just breathe with. Just settle. Be the settled, calm friend for yourself. Care for yourself this way. That part of you that can care for you, let that part be present for here so things can settle and relax. Being with yourself in an accepting way means that you can just kind of be fully A here as you are. And see what happens, see what opens up. See if that stability, that calm, gives you a new ability with a telescope of insight to really see more deeply parts of yourself that have often been invisible. Or it gives you the balance for the waves of life, that you can somehow find a way to be with things as they come, as they pass through. But it is a profound way to care for ourselves. And that's, Marjolein yesterday said, we're going to talk about the Brahmaviharas, or for each of these talks we give. And so it's not technically a Brahmavihara, but there's something that's closely related in the teachings of the Buddha that's called anukampa. And anukampa, it's a word I translate as care. It most commonly gets translated as compassion, which is a wonderful translation. For me, care has a little different connotations. I like to think that anukampa is the source for the Brahmaviharas, the source for these loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. And it's the basic, very basic movement that we have to care for things. And care in English has two meanings. It has it means to think that something is important. To value something, I care for something means I value it. And the other means that I take care of it. I offer to support it, to nourish it, to clean it, to help it be better itself. And this is a very basic instinct that we have. It's very basic to humanity that we care about things. All of you today, you've done a lot of caretaking for yourself. And you probably haven't given yourself any credit for doing it. It's just second nature. Some of it goes on without you thinking about it. Some of it is, when we say, I just want to be myself as I am, but then we have a very narrow idea of what that is. And we then define ourselves by that narrowness. Part of who you are is caring for yourself every second. Your lungs, your diaphragm. Without them breathing, you'd be in trouble. If you want to discover how much your body system cares about you, hold your breath. And then, you have to give in to what the body wants to do to care for you. It's phenomenal that we're cared for this way. I hope most of you have eaten today. That's a way of caring for yourself. Maybe you brush your teeth. That's caring for yourself. Maybe you took off your dirty clothes, old clothes, and put on clean clothes. It's a kind of caring. Probably you've come to a number of times you've sat here in the meditation hall looking for how do I sit here to care? You don't say this to yourself, care for my body, but how do you sit? You're trying to find a way to sit that works for your body, that you're not going to put too much strain on your body and wear it out in some way or get too tired. And some of you today, I hope you've had taken a nap. We've been remiss. And I apologize, but it's never too late. And that is on the first day of a retreat. Naps are kind of a good thing to do. The first day of retreat is often people are really tired. And so sometimes it's better to nap. A lot of people in our culture need to sleep more than they need meditation. And so to come here and just nap. And I've known people who've napped 3 times the first day. I'm sorry, you guys missed out. Now he tells me. But as soon as this talk's over, straight to nap. And so anyway, so there's all these little ways of caring. And all of you, I think by now, most of you by now, have cared for the center, cared for the community here. You've done Sangha service. Most of you have done your work meditation today. Some people have it after supper. And so you're offering care. Maybe you don't think of it care. You just think it was the order from high above that told you this is what you're doing. And so you're doing it dutifully, but I see it as care. I see like you're supporting and helping other retreatants, yourselves, everyone. There's care. There's care. It's all these little movements of care that go on. And there are times I have an injury in my feet. And so I went for a walk this afternoon. And part of how I care for myself is pay attention to how my feet come down and the angle in which I step, so that I kind of avoid the injury. So I'm caring. There's a way of caring for my foot so it lasts into my old age. And so care is such a basic thing. And sometimes we care for people unselfconsciously. If a stranger falls down next to us, slips on the sidewalk next to us, I think most of us, almost like this basic instinct, like, oh, come, I'll help you. Or if they start slipping and you go and try to, even before you think it, you care for them. And it's so deeply ingrained, this instinct to care. And to give into it, to spend a lot of time caring sometimes, it can feel so good. Clean care, clean compassion, clean friendliness, clean generosity, has this kind of is a it's like a balm for our whole system. It's like it can make kind of things feel so bubbly and nice or warm or cozy. It's possible. certain kind of care. So I say all this for a number of reasons. One is that maybe you can appreciate how much of the day you're appropriately caring for yourself, for others, you're opening a door for someone, you're, you know, whatever. That's part of this well-being. That's part of what we're cultivating. Take it in. You're doing it already. And then these other things we're doing, now the practice is an extension of that care. Buddhist practice is a form of care, self-care, and eventually it becomes not only practice for yourself, but for others as well. Care. So, how do we care for ourselves? Being here. Being on A. Settling. Steadying ourselves here, coming back to be here. We find the mind wandering off. And they say, hey, come on, come back. Can you bring the mind back from drifting off in thought in a way that is not agitating? Then in a way that doesn't produce the opposite that you, what you're trying to do. And I've done that. I've had like the, you know, jerking. To jerk my mind back as fast as I can. And that, do enough of that, then I'm a little bit frazzled. I had the whack-a-mole approach to thinking. You know, I'm just going to smash it. And those things don't work, but I didn't know that. It took a long time to understand how much I was agitating myself. But to learn, don't be bothered. The art of not being bothered by anything. Not be bothered by the thinking mind. Not be bothered by... I know some of you have some oddities. Like a few of you, one or two of you, have little things that are a little unusual that you do or are. And guess it's normal to be a little odd. Isn't that nice? A little bit. So just don't beat yourself up. Don't be critical of how you are. Just like, oh, look at that. I'm here with you. I'm here with you as you are. I'm here with you. I'm not going to be you, but I'm here with you. Oh, there goes the mind drifting off again. Okay, let's come back. Let's see what we can relax. How can we settle back here and be here? All this is an act of care. So if you keep care as a reference point for how you come back from a drifting mind, how you place your mind, your attention on your breathing, how you put your attention into as you walk, how you practice mindfulness of eating, all informed by a feeling of this basic human instinct to care. That's maybe simpler than the idea of compassion, but closely connected. Simpler than the idea of being friendly, but closely connected. But to a life of care. And I like to think that what Buddhism is teaching all of us is how to live a life of care. Where we know what real care is. We know the direction it's going to a place of peace, freedom, well-being that's attained by arriving here. Arriving here as you are now. Not fighting that, not criticizing that, not being dismayed by it, not being discouraged by anything that's here. Just, oh, here I am. And so some of you know, I have a practice when my mind is a little bit more active than I want it to be. I'm trying to be in the present moment, but the mind has other ideas. I'm very fond of saying the word here. H-E-R-E, here, to myself, in a very loving way, here. And it's kind of, sometimes I follow up like, oh, here is a mind that's out of control. Here. And that, when I say the here, not as the end of the end of something, it's more like the beginning of something. So I say the word here as a way of opening up, okay, to feel and sense what is here. So if the mind is agitated, then I feel the sensations of agitation. If I feel restless in my body, here, and I feel that restlessness. And it's a practice that doesn't have a long, because I do it at a time when my mind is busy, so it doesn't last very long. It only lasts like here, and then it's over. My mind is going again. And then I do it again, here. Here with this. Here. And then if I do that for a while, over and over again, something begins to settle. I'm kind of just accepting here. I'm allowing myself to be here. I'm allowing myself to feel what it's like to be here. Here. I'm not fighting it. I'm not being contentious with how things are. I'm just to be here with it. To be here with it. Over and over again. Here. Here. Sometimes it feels like I'm giving myself a grand massage of some kind. Here. And then I go off here. And so that's, and that rhythm of coming here and then coming here and coming here, something begins to settle and settle and settle. So to settle ourselves in ourselves, to stabilize ourselves here, to find a place of balance within ourselves, to find where the balance is deep inside. Where's the ballast that keeps us steady? There's a wonderful analogy, or kind of, some of you know, in Japan, they have what's called Bodhidharma dolls. And these are these, they have these here in this country. I don't know, they're dolls, kind of, they're this blow-up things that have a big round base. And if you push it, it pushes down, but it pops right back up because the base is kind of heavy, I guess. The Bodhidharma dolls, you know, no matter how much you push it, they just pop right up, pop right up. So where's the ballast? Where's the support? Where's that place of rest? Resting here. Your sitting bones on your chair, sitting bones on your cushion, that you really feel like, oh, here I am. No matter if anybody comes along that'll push me around, well, they'll push me, but I'll just come right back up. No matter what happens, you remember, you know, the person who jilted you in high school. Ooh, come right back up, find your balance. And find that place of balance. And partly what I mean, really physically, this arriving and finding stability and steadiness, think of it as a physical process, a physical project. So find where you feel steadied in your body. Find where the stability is. Find where the weight of your body rests. And the wonderful gift of doing this is the more you're at A, the more you're steadied and stable here, the greater is going to be your capacity to care, to love, to be friendly, to be compassionate. It's almost like you're, and to be aware, to be mindful. I don't want to forget those. And those are gifts. So we're kind of preparing the ground. We're tilling the soil. We're opening up. We're getting ready so that there's more space, more room, more capacity, more here of ourselves to offer ourselves these beautiful qualities that are kind of our birthright. They're there waiting for us. And so, we're stabilizing ourselves here. Here we are. So let's end with a short meditation. So you might want to, in a caring way, doing what's most caring for your body right now, And for some of you, since it's just a few minutes, and some of you maybe have been sitting this way for a long time, and maybe the most caring thing to do is to lay down. It could be so short, you're not going to fall asleep. But there might be a way of caring, and you're welcome to do it. And gently close your eyes. And for a few moments, feel the weight of your body and how the weight of your body is received by the chair, by your cushion, by the floor. Maybe how the weight of your torso above your waist is kind of received by your waist, your pelvis, your hips. Maybe softening your belly so it hangs forward a little bit. Maybe feeling how your hands and arms also are maybe being supported by something. And maybe out of that sense of support, stability that your weight and gravity provide, out of that, take a long, slow, deep breath, a few breaths. Breathe in deeply, filling your body, expanding your torso as you breathe in. And then a long exhale, where you're letting go and sliding down into the depths of your body. Follow the exhale as if it takes you right down to the most stable place within. And sitting this way, allowing yourself for a couple more minutes to sit here, like this way, how would it be for you? What would it look like? How would you do it? To care for yourself as you practice, as you're present. What would it look like if mindfulness of breathing, your body, what's happening to you? What if that was a form of care? Expressed by care, expression of care. And what might it be like if the way that you were mindful, the way that you were aware, was informed, is informed by care, by compassion, by goodwill. What would awareness look like? Informed by care. Thank you very much.